맞아요. 그래서 It's nothing. It's empty. 다시 말하자면 Buddhadasa's books called the Heartwood of the Bodhi Tree. Of course, one who knows of the Bodhi Tree, you know that the point of that is the Bodhi Tree doesn't have any heartbeat. Thinking. Now, practice, in particular meditation practice, is ultimately grounded on this radical realization of emptiness. When the Buddha came to express its central insight, this defining feature of his spiritual message, he very typically used words that were negative. He spoke about impermanence, not so. These are the things we have to realize. And when we practice those things and realize them deeply, then we realize nibbana, the absence. Vana, where vana can either be craving or it can be the air or the oxygen that sustains the flame of suffering, if you like. Sunyata, emptiness. Abjata, the unborn. Bhuta, the uncreated. Akata, the unmade. Sankata, the unconcocted. And so Buddhism is frequently accused of being a negative religion, which an accusation which of course mistakes an ontological truth, a psychological one. We should, however, be forgiving when those of other religions, as they do, sometimes make these accusations, because within Buddhism itself there are many teachers who really should know better than make the same mistake. So Buddhism is always, the perception of Nibbana is always psychologically positive. Nibbana is a shelter, a refuge, a harbour, it's the island, the far shore, a place of safety. Ultimate bliss, the coolness, and when talked about in terms of existence, the Buddha always used these negative terms, born, made, created, unconditioned. This nature of Nibbana, the transcendent dimension of Buddhism, is often neglected or sidelined, and yet if you look closely it underlies even the most basic of the forms of Buddhism and practice. For example, in the chanting which we did this evening, Nikipiso Bhagama Arahan Sama Sambuddha, and we're recollecting the qualities of the Buddha. And we're recollecting those qualities primarily which are the transcendental qualities that the Buddha has attained, especially the Bodhi itself, the awakening. We're recollecting a transcendental teacher who has universal and cosmic significance. And then the recollection of the Dhamma as well. Sandhya Tikamakariko, these terms referring to the realizable and transcendental nature of the Dhamma when we're collecting the Sangha. This is practice to realize Nyaya Patipanna, to realize the Dhamma. And so despite the appearances where Buddhism sometimes gives the appearance of being merely a devotional cult, even within these most fundamental basic expressions of Buddhist teachings recited by the Buddhist community everywhere, there's this fundamental acknowledgement, realization of a sense of transcendental awareness, something which cannot be pinned down, defined, limited, caught by words. So when we come to contemplate and Dhamma as the highest truth of Buddhism, we are constantly reminded of the limits of our knowledge and the inadequacy of our formulations. And if we are to even begin to approach a realistic or a meaningful understanding of this idea, this reality, then we must seek for Nibbana in the gaps. We seek in the absences. In a way, Nibbana is a little bit like the absence of anything, absence itself. Buddha defined Nibbana as the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. And these are the forces which distort our perception, cloud the truth. And when those forces are absent from the mind, we see clearly for the first time. This is vision of the Dhamma. And this vision, this realization of Nibbana, is something which happens as an organic outcome of the practice of the Eightfold Path. It's not something separate from it. The Buddha said that Nibbana and the Eightfold Path flow into one another like the Ganges and the Yamuna rivers. At each stage of our Buddhist practice, we abandon things. We let them go. We take up our precepts. We let go of the various kinds of unskillful action that we might do when breaking our precepts. And what is the result of that? What is the result of keeping our precepts? Do we feel like our life is diminished? Do we feel bereft? We're empty of all those things. And then we realize in our experience that it was precisely those things that were making us feel empty. Precisely those kinds of unwholesome action and skillful behavior. These are things which leach out the substance of our minds. They break up our consciousness, constantly offering and never fulfilling. The world of deficient, insatiate, slave of craving. And when we let go of those things, our mind feels curiously fuller than it did before, more complete, more whole, So this is the happiness that comes from keeping precepts. And so it is for each stage of the Buddha's path, whether it be abandoning the kinds of wrong view, abandoning unwholesome and unskillful thought and intention, correcting our precepts, correcting our livelihood, abandoning laziness and practicing right effort, developing mindfulness and keeping the mind steady in the present moment, and bringing the mind into a peace of samadhi. Each of these things leads to a deeper level of fulfillment through letting go. And we can much more easily define this progress in negative terms than we can in positive terms. We can say, for example, that we abandon wrong speech, we abandon lying, but much more difficult to say what exactly kinds of things do we say. It's harder to pin that down and define it. And this is why so often the path is defined in terms of negatives. Essence is absence. For different people, right speech might be very different, and yet they'll share that absence of false speech in common. And when all of these factors of the path come together in harmony and union, then the result is the realization of Nibbana, the vision of the truth, the arising of the eye of the Dhamma. For us to reach that stage, we have to overcome our fear of freedom, our fear of happiness, our fear, peace, this compulsion that underlies the mind that wants to fill everything, fill the mind, thoughts, fill the mind, ideas, memories, fill our lives with things, with objects, with friends. And we fear the night time, we fear the loneliness, we fear the emptiness. And when we reflect back and understand the nature of our practice, we see that each step of the way, every step where we have genuinely, humbly, sincerely followed the advice of the Buddha, followed the teaching, then that leads to letting go of rubbish. And the result of that is not a sense of being lost, not a sense of confusion and doubt. The result of those things is love, awareness, fulfillment. And we notice the reverse as well. And whenever we abandon the path, neglect our practice, whenever we don't do the right thing, when we say the wrong thing, act in the wrong way, let our mind stray into the field of wrong thought, nicca sankappa gochara in the corner. Then we become more fractured, more alienated, more lonely, more stressed. So we have to keep on reflecting on this. These are things which are not obvious. They're things which can easily be confused when experienced in the midst of the random events of our lives. And we can easily lose sight of that development of the Dhamma. And similarly of the boat which is tied up to the wall. When the boat is tied there with strong ropes and it bobs back and forth in the waves. And even when a strong storm comes and the current is trying to pull the boat away from the wall, the ropes are just too strong. It doesn't have a hope of breaking free. And the boat's tied up there for a long time with these very stout ropes. And if you were to come and look at the boat and look at those ropes, you would think that it's just going to last forever. How can that boat ever escape with such tough bonds? And yet, no matter how much you think that, each night the dew falls on the ropes, moistens them. They swell just a little bit. And the day comes, sun rises, dries out the ropes. They contract, become a little bit more brittle. The evening comes again. The damp descends on them, they swell a little. Each day and each night, this is happening. That's what time means. Time is these cycles of change. And each time this happens, the rope gradually becomes a little bit weaker. And the explanation for this simile is that the ropes, of course, are the fetters of defilements, tying us to suffering. Dew descending in the coolness of the night is the bliss of samatha practice, a body that's filled with the rapture and joy and meditation. And the bright sun that dries out the rope is the shining light of wisdom, the insight practice, the vipassana. And these two, as always, going hand in hand, helping each other. Either one of them by itself is not enough. And eventually, one day, the boat will pull and the rope will snap. And both will be free. The Buddha said, our practice is like, we can't see from one day to the next how our meditation is going, how our mind is progressing, whether we're improving or declining. We tend to get too caught up in the states of consciousness which we may have from one day to the next. And these states are important, they have a significance, but they tend to be very short-lived. And so one day we're very happy because we have good meditation, the next day we can't get that good meditation again and we feel that something's gone wrong. And so we get caught up in these very short-term things. This would be like, in that simile, if you're looking at how the boat is wearing away its ropes, and then you might find that one day there's clouds, so the sun doesn't get to dry out the rope. And you think, oh, it's so terrible. And then that night time, maybe it's a very dry night, hot night, and there's no dew. And you think, oh, this is not going to work, this is never going to work. Because these are natural variations, they always happen. But it's not about what happens on one day or on one night. It's about what happens over countless days and countless nights. And gently wearing away those defilements. There is nothing mysterious about this process. Nothing obscure about it. The way of practice that the Buddha taught is very clear. practice of contentment, of keeping precepts, of sense restraint, of right speech, gentleness and truth in speech, the practice of being energetic, the practice of being devoted to mindfulness in the daily practice, the practice of being careful about keeping one's monastic duties, studying the Dhamma, being devoted to seclusion, not overeating, not oversleeping, doing a meditation. These are the things that lead to Nibbana. You don't have to doubt it. It's not an experiment. We've been working for the last 2,500 years. It can't not lead to Nibbana. Just like the rope that ties the ship can't not break eventually. And then one reaches that point where all of these factors of the path have been developed and come to fulfillment, where feels that there is a balance and a harmony of all of these factors. And the mind will, in its own good time, penetrate through to the Dhamma. This is the moment we call stream entry. And so for the first time, the stream enterer catches a vision of the truth, like a flash of lightning in the darkness of the night. And through that vision of the truth, they let go of certain defilements, certain fetters. And the most common fetters mentioned there are the attachment to external forms of religious purification, silabhata, attachment to the wrong views, yitra-vadana, attachment to the abuse of self, akaya-ditti, attachment to doubt. So these things the stream enterer has let go of, and of course they've let go of each of these things for a specific reason. They let go of doubt because they've seen the truth. There's no need to doubt anything if you've seen it for yourself. So this is not the confidence of the fundamentalists, who insists on the truth of things that they've never known and never can know. This is the very simple confidence of someone who's been there and seen it for themselves. And on the way to Pasana, and they overcome attachment to the external forms of religious purification because they know what the real path is. They can no longer believe that by undertaking a particular vow, a particular external observance, that this can lead to true purity, because they know what the actual path is. And there is a path of inner purification, not external. And they overcome better attachment to wrong views, especially the view of self, sakaya-ditti, because they've seen truth of not self. They've seen that there isn't a permanent core essence identity which they can attach to and say, this is me. It just doesn't exist. There's nothing there. So the stream enterer has this glimpse of Nibbana, and they are set firmly upon the path. They can fall backwards to some degree. They can be more or less diligent in their practice, but from then on they're destined for Nibbana. And even though they might fall back to some degree, they'll never do anything that would be very unwholesome or anything that would cause them to take rebirth in a lower realm. When the stream enterer continues their practice, and then
and series of higher attainments, it's not clear from the suttas whether all people will actually go through each of the stages of attainment, or whether people will kind of leapfrog over one or the other in some cases. It's not entirely clear. But there are four stages mentioned. And of course the next one being the once returner, Sakadagami. And the Sakadagami is distinguished by reducing greed and hatred. They're not completely got rid of, but they're lessened. So you notice that the insights of the stream enterer in particular are essentially those insights in which get rid of the coarser forms of delusion, misunderstanding about what the path is, doubt and so on. These are particular forms that delusion takes. And yet they still have the greed and the hatred there. It can still arise. Of course, the arisen greed and hatred must have been absent earlier for them to have the clarity of mind to actually realize the truth. But the seeds of that are still not uprooted. The underlying tendencies are still there. And so the Sakadagami lessens greed and hatred. The suggestion seems to be that greed and hatred are such tenacious forces in the mind that it either requires, or at least sometimes requires, that they're overcome in stages, and they can't just be overcome all at once. And the other implication, of course, is that greed and hatred are a pair. They counteract each other. They counterbalance each other. And the anagami overcomes greed and hatred altogether. So the anagami is fairly peaceful, and regarded as being samadhi sampanna, perfected in samadhi. And since they don't have any greed and hatred, and they have got rid of doubt and so on, then they have virtually none of the five hindrances, and so they're able to get samadhi very easily. I say virtually because they still possibly have very, very remnant, very subtle hindrance, especially the hindrance of restlessness, which they haven't yet overcome. For the anagami, restlessness doesn't mean the kind of restlessness that you or I might have. It doesn't mean the kind of sitting there with their guts churning and body full of agitation. It's not that kind of restlessness. What it is for the anagami is a kind of a yearning for the Dhamma, which manifests in terms of an excessive devotion to insight practice. And the corresponding defilement for the anagami is the raga, the rupa raga and arupa raga, the attachment to form, attachment to the formless, which of course is the excess on the samatha side, or the samadhi side. And the meaning of this, I think, is caught quite well in an anecdote by Ajahn Mahabua, when he talks about his practice under Ajahn Mun. And he says that when he's practicing under Ajahn Mun, at one stage he had very good samadhi and would sit all day in jhana. And Ajahn Mun abused him, criticized him. He said, "What are you doing all day sitting there like a log? Very useless, wasting time. Go on, you've got to investigate. You've got to see impermanence. You've got to see not self." And so Ajahn Mahabua, of course, took Ajahn Mun's advice 200% and spent all day doing very active and intensive vipassana practice, hardly sleeping at all and devoting his entire time to a sort of ruthless dismemberment of anything that might constitute himself. And the result of that, that he his health started to deteriorate, and he started to become unwell. And Ajahn Mun then said, "What are you doing, Bua? You're going to kill yourself like this. Go and practice some samadhi now." These are two extremes. It's a bit of a caricature, but I think you get the idea. This is a tendency in practice which depends on different characters. And so these some of the subtle defilements which the anagami has to overcome, finding that balance in practice. And the other fetters facing the anagami is, of course, mana, in the subtle sense of I am, that hangs around, even though they don't actively think of themselves as a self. If you asked them any of the areas, even the stream entry, you ask them, is there a self? Then they'll say, of course, no, there isn't. They know that when they reflect on it. But still, if they're not reflecting on it, there's still this kind of assumption, underlying assumption of the self, which still kind of hangs around and informs the way their mind works, as we call mana. And the final defilement is, of course, avidya, unknown. And these five higher fetters are the ones overcome by the anagami. And this is what we call arahantship. So the arahant is the pinnacle of practice as taught by the Buddha. The arahant is fully let go of all defilements, all delusion, all greed, hatred, delusion. The mind is completely clear. And the vision of the truth is unsullied. This is one of the great promises of the Buddha, that this state is realizable. It's true. It's doable. It's not anything mysterious. Ending of greed, hatred, and delusion. We know what greed, hatred, and delusion are. We know what it can mean for those things to end. We don't have to have faith in any transcendental or cosmological or metaphysical speculations. This is just a straightforward reality, the ending of this. And when thinking about or speaking of the arahant, there are a number of passages and statements in the suttas which talk about this in various different ways and which can sometimes invite confusion. Some of the confusion is because of simple error or misunderstanding, and some of the confusion is because there is a genuine room for different interpretations, especially when dealing with a matter that's so subtle and so profound. It seems, according to the suttas and the Vinaya, that the realization of these stages of awakening happens at a particular place and a particular time. They are defined events in our consciousness. So anybody who is an anagami or an arahant or something should be able to say, it was on such and such a night, such and such a time, and such a place, that's when it happened, and this is what the experience was like. And they should be able to give a clear and coherent description of the experience. It seems that it's not always possible to know what these experiences are when they happen, even when they're genuine. So of course it's the case that many people mistakenly think that they've attained these things and that they're merely suffering from what Buddha called adhimana, overestimation. That was the case commonly in the Buddhist time and even more commonly today. And this is particularly a problem when the founders of different meditation lineages are themselves suffering from adhimana and encourage that in their disciples. But even for those cases when people can genuinely realize these stages, it's not always obvious what's actually going on. It seems, from anecdotal evidence, that the realization of these things is such a powerful experience that it it's a shattering, world-overturning experience. Even the realization of stream entry, and that it shifts one's perception so fundamentally that it takes time to assimilate and to understand what's been going on. So that somebody who has that experience will clearly know that something very profound has happened, but they won't necessarily immediately know exactly what it is or what to call it. And so subsequent to that, it comes a period of what they call pachavekana, which is a reviewing. And in that reviewing period, one reflects on the experience and what's happened, and in particular, one reflects on what is present and absent in the mind. And there was, the experience of stream entry was once described, and I think quite memorably, as being that parts of your mind which you didn't even know existed disappeared. And so after the experience, it may be the case that the mind is so clear and that the defilements are so weak that it will take a long time for any defilements at all to reappear in the mind. Maybe days, maybe weeks, maybe months, maybe years, I don't know. And so it's easy to take such an experience, even a genuine experience. Maybe it's a genuine experience of stream entry, but somebody might think that they've become an arahant because their mind's completely free of any defilements. And of course that's especially the case for somebody who has very good samadhi. And if you have good samadhi and you're able to maintain that for many years, then you can go for a long time without having any greed or hatred appear in the mind. But eventually the different kinds of defilements will make their way back into the mind, and one's able to sort things out. How quickly one does that and how securely depends on one's own development of wisdom. The more that you've studied the Dhamma and are clear about what the Buddha was teaching, and the better your insight, then the quicker and the clearer this process will be. So this is one great reason for taking the time to study the teachings and study the Dhamma. In some cases you may need to seek advice as to what's going on. And as progress continues, once that stage has been realized, once the Buddha always said aparapachaya, that from this stage of stream entry, that you're not dependent on another, aparapachaya. So you don't need anybody to tell you what to do anymore. You see the Eightfold Path. So it still can be the case that advice from others, from the suttas, from other accomplished teachers can be helpful or useful in certain respects. But it's not really necessary anymore. You can, inevitably, you will realize the truth even if you don't have any support or teaching. And as one continues, then one could still forget the Dhamma from time to time as a stream enter. One could still get lost into worldly thoughts and aspirations and so on. But when one reflected back to the Dhamma again, then it would all come back very quickly. And the natural train of mind is to be eager to practice and eager to follow the Dhamma. And only occasionally will one be led astray from that, as opposed to the ordinary person, is usually the other way around, that we're usually mostly distracted, and only when we really make ourselves and remind ourselves to follow the Dhamma. And this experience goes on until arahantship. Now the experience of arahantship, like that of stream entry, one's return, non-return, is an actual time and a place, it's an actual experience. May or may not happen in meditation itself. Experience itself, it seems, is fairly short. brief experience. Now, there are a number of different conditions which are spoken of in the suttas and which can be confused. One is the experience or the state of simply being an arahant. Now, being an arahant, there is no greed, hatred or delusion. And so in that sense, arahantship is defined by the Buddha the same as Nibbana is also, the absence of greed, hatred and delusion. But in that respect, arahantship, apart from the absence of greed, hatred and delusion, has no particular positive quality, by which I simply mean that arahants can be very different in who they are, what they think, what they do, what kind of personality they have, and all of these things will be still conditioned by their past conditioning. Thai arahant will remain Thai, a German arahant will remain German, an Australian arahant will remain Australian. They will keep the tendencies, habits, conditions and so on that they had beforehand, but they won't suffer because of them. And so there's no specific content to arahantship in this sense. Arahants will see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think. They have beliefs, they have memories, they have perceptions, they have ideas. Their minds work pretty much the same as your mind or my mind. Now, in addition to arahantship in that sense, there's also something which is a little bit more mysterious and a bit more problematic, and that is a specific kind of meditation state which it seems the arahants are able to attain from time to time. And this particular kind of meditative state is analysed and discussed in quite some detail in Bhikkhunyanananda's wonderful book Concept and Reality, which I strongly recommend you should all read. And he talks about the various passages from the suttas that seem to suggest that from time to time an arahant will realize what's called the anyapala, the fruit of true knowledge, and that this is a particular meditation attainment based on, for example, it's described as nibbanam bhavanirodho, nibbanam bhavanirodho. Nibbana is the ending of existence. Nibbana is the ending of existence. And in the... it's a very kind of mysterious meditative state. It's not identical with the cessation of perception and feeling. Nor is it exactly identical with any of the normal samadhi attainments. And it's regarded in some ways as a realization of nibbana here and now, like a foretaste of final nibbana. And so as well as these aspects of enlightenment or arahantship, then of course the most mysterious of all is what we call parinibbana, the state of an arahant as they pass away. And this is something which is quite disputed in the Buddhist schools, and essentially you have two different conceptions of nibbana. One is that final nibbana in this sense is a positive state, an existent reality, a transcendental reality to be sure, but still something real. And this is the position of the Theravadin school, which claims that nibbana is a swabhava, a truly self-existent phenomenon, which exists externally and objectively. So the Theravadin school does not go to any great lengths to define this. The Abhidhamma, Theravadin Abhidhamma, merely talks about Nibbana as the asankata dhatu, the unconditioned element, without further elaboration. There's a very interesting discussion of this in one of Bhikkhu Nyanamoli's footnotes in the Visuddhimagga, and where he points to a conversation between two monks that's recorded in the commentaries. And in that conversation, the monk who's arguing from the Theravadan point of view wins the argument by quoting a sutra. And the sutra he quotes says, on coming to that tangangama, the defilements are pacified. And that phrase, tangangama, on coming to that, suggests that there's an external objective reality on arriving at which the defilements are pacified. And when this passage was quoted, the sutta passage was quoted in support of this argument, the opponent fell silent. The intriguing thing is that that particular passage is not found in the Pali Canon. So that's that. Of course, the idea of Nibbana as a positive entity is also found within certain of the Mahayana schools as well. Although it's by no means the case that it was universal among Indian Mahayana, even the Yogacara school, it seems, did not believe in Nibbana as an existing entity, at least in the early stages. The most if that doctrine of Nibbana as an existing entity is assumed, then of course the next question is, what kind of existing entity, what kind of state is it? Theravadan school did not answer that. The later forms of the Yogacara school identified Nibbana as a kind of transcendental or universal consciousness. And it has to be very clear here that the early teachers of the Yogacara, Sangha and Vasubandhu, denied this idea and did not teach this, but their commentators and the later developers taught that. And they talked about the alaya vijnana, some kind of transcendental consciousness as constituting the essence of Nibbana. Others say that this idea is basically indistinguishable from the Upanishad view. I agree with that, but it is, of course, quite widespread in Thailand, this idea of the original mind as being Nibbana. Whether the Thai idea of the original mind is influenced somehow by Yogacara ideas, perhaps filtering down from China, or perhaps as part of the substratum of Thai Buddhism that predates the advent of Theravada, or whether it's an independent development based purely on meditative experience, I don't know. But that view is held by some of the forest masters, certainly not by all of them. And when Ajahn Chah was asked about the original mind, his response was, and why isn't the original mind, isn't that Nibbana? He said, what are you talking about? The original mind. He pointed to a cup. He said, see that cup's there, it's in that spot. What happens if I take away the cup? Well, there's the original spot. Is there anything there? It's gone. Finished. Jop was the word he used. Jop. There's nothing there. But you have to call it the original spot, because otherwise you just grunt at each other. So this was Ajahn Chah's understanding of the idea of the original mind. But some of the other forest ajahns, particularly Ajahn Mahabua, seem to take it much more literally as a kind of transcendental, universal, permanent consciousness. And on the other hand, apart from these ideas, then there's the idea of Nibbana as nothing and sheer cessation, Nirodha Matta. And of course the most well-known exponent of that these days is Ajahn Brahm, who is strongly resistant to any idea of Nibbana as some kind of transcendental or metaphysical entity of any sort. It's probably fair enough to say that within the suttas that people who wish to seek justification for any of these views can find certain passages that will they seem to lend those views some support. It's equally fair to say that without a shadow of a doubt, the by far the most common and characteristic way that the Buddha talked about Nibbana was of absence, of emptiness. And although you can find a few passages which seem to perhaps or can be construed as giving a more positive existence to Nibbana as a state, in the scheme of things, you're kind of scratching around pretty desperately to foster that kind of idea. So this is like the final way that Nibbana is spoken of, and the complete ending of everything. Consciousness ends, the five khandhas end, existence ends, rebirth ends, samsara ends, suffering ends. Anything that you can, that you've known, seen, thought of, identified with, it's gone. And the Buddha said, yeni yena himanyanti tatodam hoti himantam. Whatever you think it is, the reality is something else. So whatever we think of Nibbana, a long, long, long way from what the reality of Nibbana is. So for those of us who are practicing the Buddha's path, the thought of Nibbana should be a thought of peace. It should be a thought of joy. It should be a thought of comfort. It should be a reassurance to us that our path has a goal. And it's not mere aimless wandering. That everything has its time. Everything has its context. And that nothing we do as part of our Buddhist path is devoid of meaning. So I offer this talk for you this evening on the goal of Buddhist practice. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments or reflections or questions.
Total eradication of greed, hatred and delusion. I think that many of us, if we are honest enough and brave enough, we may be able to see our own greed and hatred. But how does one become aware of one's delusion?
Do you know Ajahn Chah's answer to that question? Yeah? Have you heard?
I may have forgotten.
Somebody once asked Ajahn Chah that in Western Army. Somebody translated the response, but unfortunately they got the response translation wrong. So what Ajahn Chah's response was, he said, you're riding a horse. And you're saying, where's the horse? Where's the horse? And unfortunately, in Thai, to ride a horse, if I remember correctly, is kima, whereas dog shit is kima. kima, I put my tongue wrong there. Anyway, you get the idea. So, the translator said, translated as, you're shoveling dog shit and you're asking, where's the dog? Where's the dog?
That's exactly Bhante. A lot of time we are not aware of a lot of things we are doing. That kind of mind, I believe, is very hard to become aware of.
It is, yeah. It is. So, this is why we have to become develop practice gradually, and remember that first of all, if greed and hatred are easier to identify, and they're certainly not that easy to identify, but if they are easier to identify, then the more we can eradicate greed and hatred, then the more clearly we see, the more we'll be able to overcome delusion as well. Yeah? So these are not, in practical terms, they're not different kinds of goals. But also to remember that delusion comes in many forms, both coarse and subtle. So the most subtle forms of it are only overcome by the anagami. But for us, then there are many things which many more obvious forms of delusion which we can overcome through very straightforward means, such as studying the suttas, which overcomes the kinds of delusion which underlie one view, such as reflecting on our actions, which overcomes a form of delusion about unknowing what we're doing as also, and so on. So there's many different kinds of delusion which we can overcome bit by bit.
I just feel that many of us are always caught in what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is bad, and then we are, because of all these attachments to our own fixed views and all that, a lot of sufferings are resulting from, the sufferings for self and even for others are resulting from other things. So I just feel that it's really not that easy for one to be really aware that we are actually causing suffering to oneself and to others. I do not know whether that is really part of the delusion that we're going through.
Of course it is. Yeah. Of course it's why we cause suffering, because it's delusion. But there's no mystery to overcoming that. It's a very straightforward process.
Sūpaṭipanno bhagavato